Okay, so I wahoo to fellow Wahoos. Nice to be back. Many a happy day here from 77 to 81 before most of you were born. A couple exceptions here. I'm going to start. I'm going to tell you the little tale of how I got into a little bit of trouble, as they say, and I met Kurt, who then...
In that order,
that's right. Got into trouble and met Kurt, who then was my lawyer, to help me through the shoals of fear and panic. I should also say that my mother wanted me to go to law school, and she didn't say it was okay. I could be a journalist until after I'd actually won the Pulitzer Prize. That's when she says, okay, I guess now it's okay, she said. I've been a journalist for 30 years. During a time of enormous change in the landscape, the firmament of this thing that I do, which of course has a very long history, certainly back long before America. People have been writing narrative, Homer, among others, to try to tell the stories of civilizations. I also, though, am fortunate to have become a journalist during the 20th century, which was kind of a glory days period for journalism, when we dealt with these issues of a professional press that attempted and was supported in arriving at a kind of objectivity rather than a more tendentious, politicized press that we see in many countries now and that was largely the way things worked in the 19th century and before. Get right to where things got heated and interesting. And I think it also, in this framing, helps people understand why the media, why the press, why reporters like me do what we do. And eventually we'll get to a Q&A and discuss why some of these things are now imperiled by some of the shifts in the landscape in this period. In fact, many of them under Barack Obama. That'll be the end of our discussion. And now many of the issues we're talking about in terms of the flow of information in a free society and how some of the legal landscape has shifted happens forcefully under George W. Bush. But many of these issues have been deepened and expanded by Obama, by the Obama administration, which is a shock to many journalists who were feeling that a constitutional law professor as president would somehow stand against the traditional manner in which power exercises its prerogatives. But I think we have been taught otherwise. Back with a president who seemed to understand power in a different way, Bush, who expanded the office, I believe. Vice Cheney was behind it, but Bush was the guy who was president, I think, at that point. We were living in a period when, I guess lots of you folks, some of you might have been in high school or younger, that is defining, certainly to your generation, or many of the folks here in the room, certainly my 25-year-old son, it was the seminal event of his childhood as 9/11. And I was working on a book, a different book, at 9/11. But then a few months after, as a journalist, I got a call from a friend of mine who's the editor of a magazine called Esquire. And he said, boy, you know, things have really changed in the last couple months. Now, those months after 9/11 were, I think, unique, certainly to this modern period, in terms of a kind of jingoism, a kind of notion of defining patriotism through concerted action. The country was really battered, and we were stunned. And fear was the currency of that day. And a currency that, to be fair, the Bush administration was brilliant at managing. There's nothing new here. Hope and fear are what presidents manage. But in terms of fear, they were particularly adept. And one of the ways in which they were adept was to use this fear environment, this are you with us or against us concept, to reframe what the press did. Now, they were never lovers of the press. And I can tell you stories during the Q&A of their position on the role of the media. They did not see us as having a special role. They saw us as another interest group. And early on in the administration, it was said as such to various reporters. Karen Hughes, basically, who's Bush's advisor, media advisor, thinker, she and Karl Rove, the two key actors in that beginning of the Bush administration, said, look, we view as another interest group. We have a designated friendly media now, Fox News and others, that can carry our message. We don't need the mainstream press. The New York Times, Washington Post, even the Wall Street Journal, reporters certainly, not the editorial, but we don't need you. We go around you. That was the environment we were in. But after 9/11, all manner of tools ended up in the toolkit of the Bush administration, and they used them. They were tactically forceful and quite clear-eyed. One of them was to essentially treat journalists, asking the questions that journalists are trained to ask, as unpatriotic. And it worked. So, in the early part of 2002, when Bush has an 87-88% approval rating and he is riding high, I happen to wander into the White House to write one of two pieces for Esquire magazine. Now, they had read a previous book I wrote called A Hope in the Unseen about race and education, and the book is written very carefully to not offer any prescriptions. It's just the story of a kid from a blighted urban high school in Washington, D.C. who goes to Brown University. They liked the book. Folks on the left liked it too. And they were feeling kind of pumped up. You know, we could use a Boswell. We are giants. We could use a biographer. Come on in, Susskind, here. Sit there. I know. It's amazing to think about. I had a desk in the West Wing of the White House. You know, one I sat at. I wasn't a member, but, you know, there, Karl Rove. Hey, Karl. Hey, Condi. You know, nice to see you too. I wrote two stories for Esquire that created havoc. Because I am a reporter. I carry, you know, one of these babies. I'm not on any team. And the White House was displeased. At that point, I basically had a restraining order. I couldn't go south of DuPont Circle. But the way this works is that the thing that reporters do is a special endeavor. It is the reason, I dare say, it is the only endeavor listed in the documents that are holy, the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Even the founders, who had no great love for the James Calendars of that era, said, you know, we need the reporters because there is no other way. Even Jefferson, our patron, said, you know, if I had to keep one institution in a free society, one, I think it would be the free press. Even after he had been battered by them in many instances. He says there's no other way to hold power, hold it, the feet to the fire for power and keep them accountable. So we get right to the core of it. I had written a second piece for Esquire the same week in December of 2002, the same week a guy named Paul O'Neill, who was the Treasury Secretary for the first 2 years under the Bush presidency, the same week Paul O'Neill was fired by Dick Cheney. Because O'Neill basically said several things that have been proven mightily correct. He's a conservative Republican, but he's also reality-based, fact-driven, was the CEO of Alcoa, and before that had served many presidents, you know, from Johnson through Gerald Ford, Nixon. And O'Neill said, you know, among other things, you can't cut taxes in a time of war. We've got one going in Afghanistan, late 2002. We got another one on the docket in Iraq. It's unprecedented, Dick Cheney, he said, to cut taxes in a time of war. It's irresponsible. We'll blow a hole in the budget, those 2003 tax cuts that we will spend decades repaying, which is what happened. O'Neill, because he says, I can't sell this tax cut, got fired. A month after he's fired, because it takes about a month for a Treasury Secretary to get out of office, to get unwound, I'm in the kitchen with my wife, who is a brilliant woman. I'm very fortunate. And she has a flyer, a little pink thing, from something called the Sulgrave Club in Washington, D.C. Now, that's a club. It's like the Metropolitan Club, but it's for women. It's kind of a women's eating and social club. Mostly older women, you know, a lot of blue hairs. But Cornelia, my wife, was part of the Young Persons Committee. And she says, hey, look, It says Paul O'Neill will be speaking at the Salgrave Club tomorrow night. This is 2 days after he's officially out of office, scandalized. I see, honey, he is not speaking anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. The man is in the witness relocation program. He just got fired. She's like, well, you know, just one phone call. You know, maybe he's going to show up. He does. And there I am with O'Neill. Now, O'Neill is a fascinating character who I don't know that much about at this point. But, you know, I feel an opportunity to so-called bag an elephant. So I give O'Neill, we're there at the Salgrave Club, and he's surrounded by lots of tall, white-haired men wearing blue Brooks Brothers suits. O'Neill's a small, he's about my height. So I see him there inside of this grove of sequoias. I kind of elbow in. And the Washington Post had written about me previous month, so O'Neill saw the picture. He's like, you're the guy who wrote those stories about the White House and Esquire. I said, yeah. And the core guy of the story, the key guy, was a guy named John DiUlio, who ran the faith-based program, who left. And DiUlio's a guy who had reviewed A Hope in the Unseen, my other book for The New Republic. We didn't know each other. We knew each other at a distance. DiUlio said profound and important things. The first guy to leave the Bush administration to speak with real clarity, off message. And of course, DiUlio, before the second of the two stories that DiUlio was in Esquire came out in December, the same week Paul O'Neill's fired, DiUlio called me up and he says, well, you know, I know this is going to be tough, but I know I spoke with clarity here, but I think most presidents, they appreciate this eventually when an advisor says, here's what's real and important. DiUlio, among other things, said that the Bush administration, because they had no policy apparatus, that the political mandate drove policy, that it was what he called the reign of the Mayberry Machiavellis. You know, it's the kind of quote you don't get very often. The Bush administration was deeply dispirited by that. And DiUlio was called to task. By the afternoon the story appeared, DiUlio was basically pleading insanity. Karl Rove and others called him up, said, you have hurt the president. And you must now make amends. DiUlio said, my own comments are baseless and groundless. My own experiences are baseless and groundless. It's interesting. O'Neill standing there, he's like, I saw that thing that happened to DiUlio. You know, here's the thing. You know, I thought a lot about that. What do I do now that I'm out? You know, do I just take a vow of silence for the rest of my life? Am I forever in the basement of the message department? I don't know what to do, how to act. He says, but Ron, let me explain this to you. These guys are particularly nasty in a tactically forceful way. And he's known Cheney for 30 years, O'Neill, at this point. They make you pay. And poor DiUlio, he's a young guy like you. I guess he had to make a tough call. Could he afford a 50-year struggle with him? Could he afford that personally and professionally? And I guess he decided he couldn't. So he pled for mercy. Then O'Neill gets this kind of funny look. You know, he's a guy, when he's thinking deeply, he looks away from me. He's got like, what's it, gaze aversion? Is it? So he looks away. So I'm ready to leave. And he said, no, come here. Here's the difference. I'm an old guy, and I'm really rich. So there's nothing they can do to hurt me. Now, that's quite a statement. I thought it was a joke. And then I realized it wasn't a joke, half in jest at best. So O'Neill and I all of a sudden are kind of in this funny little place together. We meet. He's got a place at the Watergate. You know, he was the chief of Alcoa during the glory days. He was one of the most successful CEOs of the 1990s, more than Cisco or even those companies. He turned Alcoa around. So he's worth about $100+ million. So we're sitting there and we have these breakfasts and we just talk about each other and about our lives and nothing too product oriented. And after a while he's like, okay, so I'm ready. What do we do? I said, well, okay, it's my book. You're just the protagonist. So I got to write whatever I find. Okay, I got that. O'Neill actually was oddly kind of a transparency zealot, way back before lots of people were. You know, in Alcoa in 89, 90, he had them all in cube farms. He threw them all out of their offices, you know, way before Microsoft. He says, you know, sunlight's best, just like Brandeis. So he says, okay, well, I got something for you. And he gives me a disc with all the meetings he had as a Treasury Secretary. 7,820 meetings, calls, every bit, every moment on his schedule for 2 years. Who called whom, subject, who hung up, what meeting he went to, subject to the meeting. It's beautiful. Heaven. Now, of course, as a reporter, you're never satisfied. And I am saying, that's great. So, but before and after each of these meetings, they're documents, right? It's like, yeah. They produce them before you go into the meeting, like the National Security Council, and after, you know, as to what happened. I said, where are all those documents now? He said, well, they're back at the Treasury Department. I said, really? I said, I guess that's a problem. He's like, yeah, I think it's a problem. I said, okay, well, let me check around as to what you're entitled to as a Treasury Secretary, legally. So I do. Check with a lawyer at Sidley in Austin named Tom Green, who you can check him on Google. He's kind of a Washington Bigfoot, like Bob Bennett, one of those guys. And he did Watergate and Iran-Contra. And he says, well, you know, look, Ronnie, he's an older guy. You know, O'Neill's he's a Treasury Secretary. They're like mini presidents. Anything not stamp classified, you can get a copy of. I mean, Jesus, Jim Baker, he's got 40 boxes in his garage, what I understand. It's like, fine. So I tell O'Neill this. O'Neill goes back to Treasury one day in March, sees a guy named David Offhauser, general counsel. They're all lawyers here. Everyone's a lawyer. Offhauser's general counsel of Treasury. Used to work for O'Neill. When a Treasury Secretary leaves, there's often a changeover. Lots of people are looking for jobs. Offhauser's one of them. And O'Neill says, look, I'm going to be at the center of a book by this Susskind guy. Oh, yeah, sure, Susskind. And I need documents. What am I entitled to? And Officer says, I'm not sure. And O'Neill says, well, Susskind, check with Tom Green at Sidley and Austin. He says anything not stamp classified, I can get a copy of. At this point, Offhauser was interviewing with Tom Green at Sidley and Austin for a job. He's like, well, Green's he's the best. He ought to know. Offhauser does check as to what O'Neill's entitled to, and a couple weeks pass. And O'Neill calls me up, says, hey, I saw Offhauser again. Now, O'Neill's got a big house in Pittsburgh, and he's got his place in Washington. He's like, look, he gave me something, Ron. I said, really? Yeah. I said, where are you right now? He says, I'm at the Treasury Department. He says, but I'm driving back to Pittsburgh. So what I'll do is, I'll leave it for you at the front desk of the Watergate. Right. So I go to the Watergate. There's a big security guard. They're a big, kind of handsome African-American guy. And he's like, I got something for you here. And he gives it to me. It's 19,000 documents. 30 years after Watergate. We're full circle back. And he said, God bless you. And at that point, I accepted Jesus as my personal savior. And then I hired an assistant that next day, because they were all what's called image files, TIFF files. So we had to, I got some nice, brilliant, young Harvard guy who then would not sleep for the next year. And we organized them into a kind of a search model. And then I write a book called The Price of Loyalty. Now, The Price of Loyalty comes out almost a year to the day from our first encounter. And I'm on 60 Minutes with Paul O'Neill. On the Sunday, January the 11th, before the book is released on January 13th, 2004. Now, I tell Leslie Stahl, who's the 60 Minutes person doing our big report, it's one of those two-part things, look, some of these documents say I don't have the underlying document, because from Treasury, the program cleaned off the underlying documents that were marked classified, but it left the cover sheets. And you can tell a lot from a cover sheet, an awful lot. So I use the cover sheets in my reporting. And one big giant cover sheet that caused enormous havoc on 60 Minutes was from the first National Security Council meeting of the Bush presidency. Item 3, classified, top secret, political military plan for post-Saddam Iraq crisis. What does this say? Of course, I call everyone and ask them about it. And specifically, it says that from the first National Security Council meeting of this presidency, it was all about how to overthrow Saddam Hussein. It wasn't about 9/11. It was the first meeting. O'Neill and everyone else in the room described what happened. When you've got a document with people's names on it, they are forthcoming. They're like, what's the point of lying? He's got it. And basically, as O'Neill described it, Bush said, I want to overthrow Hussein. Finish unfinished business. My father. And there's these oil fields, right? Vice. Called Cheney Vice. So O'Neill says, just had to do it. Wasn't even a question. Just find me a way to do it. This was the worst possible document for the Bush administration to see. We're in 2004, and they have worked furiously, and frankly, successfully with a competitor of mine named Bob Woodward to make sure people thought the Iraq invasion was causal because of 9/11. Not. So, next morning, my wife's in the kitchen, and the phone rings. I told Leslie Stahl, say I don't have the underlying packet. That got cut. Bush and Cheney and the gang watched the report on Sunday night. So the next morning, a call from a guy named Jeffrey Rush, the Inspector General of the Treasury Department, comes to my kitchen. My wife answers the phone. He says, is this Mrs. Susskind? She says, yes. He says, wife of Ron Susskind, yes. Your husband is under federal investigation. We're going to send some people to your house to seize documents that we understand are in his office behind the house. Now, my wife is, you know, black Irish, ferocious, tougher than me. And she said, excuse me, I don't know if you've checked, but in case you haven't, my husband is a journalist. He's protected by the First Amendment. No one's coming to my house to seize anything. Now, Rush is kind of knocked back just for about 3-4 seconds. At which point she slips right in and says, but all peaches and cream, if you'd be nice enough to give me your phone number, Mr. Rush, I'm sure I can have my husband call you back. And he does leave his phone number. She breaks into the studio line at NPR. I'm doing an interview with Terry Gross for the book, which is out Tuesday. This is Monday, Sunday night, 60 Minutes. Bush is in Mexico being asked about Paul O'Neill. It's havoc. Global news cycles are worrying. The first real disclosure inside the great dome of silence, it's the Bush administration. So she's on the studio line. Honey, can you go to a secure room? I do. NPR's got one right off the studio. She's like, you need a lawyer yesterday. You're under federal investigation. I'm like, oh, good God. So we schemed to find a lawyer. I called up a friend of mine, Tom Green, same guy, did Iran-Contra, did Watergate. I said, Tom, I'm under federal investigation. What do I do? He's like, Ronnie, you're screwed. You can't fight him. You're one guy. I mean, you know, you can't pay for the legal bills you'll need for an hour, much less a year. And they know it. I said, well, there's got to be something here. He's like, yeah. Let me make a few phone calls. Maybe we can get you a pro bono team at one of the big firms. You know, you're kind of, you know, it's big news what you're doing. Fine. So he does. Calls up a firm called Wilmer Cutler in those days, now Wilmer Hale. And he knows a guy named Randy Moss who used to handle issues like this at the Treasury Department. And next thing you know, he and a guy named Pat Carome was the Washington Post lawyer, are calling back Jeffrey Rush at Treasury. And I have a team to answer this call because I don't want to call them back. Green is clear on that. You can't call Jeffrey Rush back. You need a lawyer to call him back. A team of them, all the better. things are a little heated for those first 2 weeks. Because I put on the book jacket that I would be posting pertinent documents from the book on my website. This is early, but it's pertinent to what's going on now. So the day before that's happening, I get a call. I'm doing homework with my son, Owen. I get a call from the White House operator saying, White House operator, hold for John Snow, then the Treasury Secretary. And I'm like, John, what's up? He's like, well, you know, we're having a bad day here at the White House, Ron. We understand you're posting these documents tomorrow. And George Tenet, CIA director, Condi Rice, and I, and we're just apoplectic here. You know, there's some things in those 19,000 that, you know, well, you know, could damage the national security of the United States. I said, well, John, I know the documents you're concerned about, and I'm not going to post them. You know, I love the country. I'm not going to compromise the country. For what? Oh, God, I am so happy to hear that. I posted documents the next day. I did not post the ones I knew he was concerned about. None of them are stamp classified, mind you, but there's some that were quite pertinent. Another week passes, and Wilmer Cutler has a meeting of the pro bono committee. Now, mind you, I've got three lawyers on the line. Randy Moss, Pat Carome, and another lawyer. They're all charging about $500 an hour. I'm a journalist. I said after the third call, I says, at these rates, I can't even afford to speak. This is going to work. Simon & Schuster, my publisher, which is not the Washington Post or the New York Times and is not used to this sort of thing, says, look, Ron, we can put $20,000 in a defense fund, but we can't do more than that. Mind you, at the same time, though, the book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So I'm like, isn't there some trade here? I don't want to go to jail. I lose in front of Wilmer's pro bono committee. Someone from Wilmer probably could tell you why. I understood secondhand that someone from the White House called Wilmer Cutler and said, if you take Susskind pro bono, it will be duly noted in the many lines of business Wilmer has with the U.S. government. I lose. I'm really about to drop through the slots. At which point, Pat Carome, one of the lawyers at Wilmer who's feeling not so good about me losing, says, you know, I hate to do this, but our arch rival, Covington, well, you got some lawyers over there. Yeah. Let me make a call for you. And he does. Calls a guy named Mark Lynch, who handled a case that was one of the few, maybe only case that was similar to mine. And his partner in crime, Kurt Wimmer, who is with us today. So this is how I met Kurt Wimmer. And now I can throw it right to you, Kurt.
So we have a lot of interesting clients, but I'd have to say this is one of my more interesting clients. We, Mark and I came to a conference room with Ron, who had one of these tiny pads and a bunch of DVDs, which he slid across the desk and said, I have 19,000 classified documents. And they want them back. So we lowered the shades and talked about what we might do. And it's a really interesting problem, the notion that the government can ask you to give classified documents back. I mean, as you can imagine, this would mean rifling through the Washington Post's file cabinets, rifling through the New York Times file cabinets, pulling back classified documents that had been either given out by mistake or leaked by a whistleblower. The thing that was really unusual about Ron's case, though, was you didn't have a confidential source, you didn't have a whistleblower, you didn't have a leaker. They just made a mistake. They gave Secretary O'Neill 19,000 classified documents that he wasn't entitled to, and now their problem was that they needed to get them back. And as it turns out, legally, that put Ron in probably the best position he could have been in. He didn't really know it at the time, but this was really a good position. Because he had done nothing illegal to get the documents. They had simply been deposited to him in a way that wasn't really challengeable. There's a case called Bartnicki versus Volper that establishes in the Supreme Court that if you get something that you something you're not entitled to have, something that might even be illegal for you to make on your own, but it's acquired by you without breaking a law, and you're a journalist, there's a First Amendment right to maintain that information. So you know, the notion that they would ask Ron for these documents back didn't have a strong legal basis. We also did some research into the Espionage Act and what they might charge Ron with, which I'm sure was on your mind at the time.
It was.
And in fact, it's a difficult argument. He had 19,000 classified documents, but they had been given to him by the government. And the notion that the government can give you something and then say, well, now it's going to harm the national security, doesn't really work very well. In fact, the government really needs to just take better care of its documents. Many people believe that just having a classified document is somehow illegal, that classification means that the document itself is subject to some greater level of protection. And a lot of senators actually believe that. That is not really the case. The Espionage Act doesn't protect classified documents, and we have a massive overclassification problem in the U.S. now. It protects documents that could harm the national security. And there are cases in the FOIA context where if a document has been made public by the government, it can no longer be held to be something that can harm the national security. So we had a lot of arguments that we could use to go back at the CIA and Treasury and say, look, you're not entitled to them as a matter of First Amendment law or journalistic practice, you're not entitled to them under the law, under the statutory law of the United States, putting aside the First Amendment. And then the strategic question comes up. Well, assuming you feel like you've got pretty strong legal arguments, do you really want to take on the United States of America? Because as Tom Green said, I think Tom was right, it is a huge undertaking to fight the U.S. government in a matter like this. Even if you do have a law firm in your corner, it's going to be a lot of work. It's going to become a crisis at times. It'll be a quest. So we engaged in a process that was sort of creative appeasement, I guess. And I don't know if you want to talk about that or if I should fill in.
Well, we can do Q&A, and Kirk can sit with me, and we can go back and forth and tell you exactly how we worked it out, and then we can open up to Q&A. Because, these issues are pertinent in all sorts of ways to not just what I do as a reporter or attempt to do, but also in terms of what we see right now with Ed Snowden, Edward Snowden, as well as with other sources. I mentioned one, James Cartwright, who is right now under Justice Department probe. He's the vice chair, was the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He leaked something, a very traditional leak, to David Sanger, the New York Times. Very much like an O'Neill-type character, senior official, who's offering a strategic leak, obviously much smaller than O'Neill, and he's not as high-ranking, but still a traditional leaker in Washington. All the things that Kurt and I fought over with the Bush administration have essentially representations now in the Obama administration. And if you want to understand how things have changed from then to now, you can place our case next to the current cases to get a sense of the trajectory, the arc of it. Now, what's interesting is that they had done two things, the Bush administration. After I got the documents from O'Neill, Bush filed an executive order in 2003 saying that we can call back documents that we think have been improperly released. Now, this is really just pure coercion. It's saying that if you're a journalist with a document and we think you shouldn't have it, you're going to have to hire a lawyer if you want to keep it. Now, most journalists can't hire lawyers. And most news establishments, especially nowadays, they're under some stress financially, don't want to hire lawyers. This is the way power works. Make them pay. After a while, it'll shape behavior. Plain and simple. Nothing new there. Now, in this case, after 2 months of heated back and forth, in April 2004, the Bush administration said, it was the same day Richard Clark, you may remember him, got up in front of his in the Senate hearing and said, we messed up on 9/11 and we're sorry. That day, they sent out a press release that Ron Suskind and Paul O'Neill have violated no laws. But then the question remained, of what to do, because they said 140 of the documents Susskind has in his possession should have been marked classified, but were not. That was our error, but we want them back. All right, now I kept O'Neill out of this. I didn't want them to go to O'Neill, a private citizen, not protected by the First Amendment, and start twisting his arm and saying, well, Paul, you were the one who was given the documents, go get them back. I said, I'm protected by the First Amendment, let me handle it. But that meant at that moment, I had an issue of holding in my office 19,000 documents, 140 of which the government said were classified. Some of them were ones I knew they were interested in, let's just say. And though they overclassify so many things, everything down to the lunch menu under Dick Cheney, that was part of his practice, that there were a few things here that I was shocked were not stamped. I think part of it was the havoc that occurred after 9/11. Things were moving too fast. The question is, what do I do with those documents? That was our battle across several years. Some of those documents were pertinent to me as a reporter and became at least a starting point to the next book, The 1% Doctrine, which is filled with secret, non-public information. And we can tell you about how that worked too, because these things move in a progression. The question is, what do we do? Was a question that Kurt and I then started to fight with the administration. They had a team of lawyers. I, thank goodness, had Kurt and Mark Lynch, but mostly Kurt was the guy who was in the day-to-day struggle. So Kurt, tell them what the bright, sharp line of discretion was on what to do about those documents.
Well, you know, clearly they were not getting them back. I mean, that was, you know, something we agreed on from the beginning. But if you think about it, does it make sense to sort of say, don't call me, you're not getting them back. If you want to do anything about it, you know, bring an action. To sort of bait them into doing that struck us as a bad idea. On the other hand, talking to them about, you know, why they need them back, sort of explaining our legal position to them, letting them know that, you know, we really didn't think they had any right to have them back, but we'd be happy to listen to their rationale about why they did want them back, seemed to us to make sense from a couple of perspectives. One, it runs out the clock a bit. You know, any classified document seems like a huge crisis at the moment it's released. Over time, you know, some of them, except for the first one that you mentioned, become less and less interesting, and time falls off, and then, you know, the clock runs out, basically. Plus, while you're negotiating with them in good faith, you're much less likely to be indicted, which was important to Ron and his wife. So we began the process of negotiating with the CIA and the Treasury Department. Which led me to the interesting experience of being in a SCIF, which is where you look at classified documents. I mean, even though Ron had these in his garage and I had them in my office, for them to show them to me.
I forgot about that. That's
you had to actually go in the SCIF, which is a secure document area. You had to leave your cell phone behind, you know, no recordable media. All you could take in was a pad. And you were allowed to take notes. And so they went through each document and explained
why. And you being able to take notes is different. Now, again, if you want to understand how this works, and I will stress to you as lawyers, but also as citizens, that the shifts that have gone on here, and we're part of it, and it has been expanded, will change your role as citizens. Make no mistake. This is about power balances and about the flow of information. You will not get the disclosures in the future. The disclosures I had in this book, and certainly in the 1% Doctrine, are obtainable in this period at significant peril to the journalists or the bloggers, as Ed Snowden knows. So here we have a dilemma, because they are saying to us, okay, Kirk can come into the room. Now the Gang of Eight, those are folks in the Senate, who are designated and the House who are designated on the intelligence committees of both of going into a SCIF, basically, and looking at classified documents. They can't even bring notes. They have to literally ingest the things. They're senators or congressmen. Ingest it and then walk out.
And these are complicated matters. It's not like, you know, it's, you know, something quick and easy to understand.
But again, it's part of the way the information gets controlled. Why are those oversight committee representatives going into the SCIF, into that room? That's because they are legally designated since the 70s to exert oversight over CIA and NSA. That's their job. Imagine how difficult that is if you go into a room and read a pile of things and you can't even take a note. That's why some of these oversight capacities have been diminished. So Kurt is in the SCIF looking at documents.
Well, and we made it clear that you weren't going to sign an NDA or any other type of document with the government that would allow him to hear the explanation, because the explanation is itself classified.
Right.
I did sign the NDA, so I can't tell you anything about what I heard, but the process was quite interesting.
I can tell you
what. He can do that. I basically said, look, I've got to be able to disclose to my client. I mean, I'm the attorney for the client. I'm not doing this for myself. We worked that through. But luckily, Ron never had to sign anything. So I'm in the SCIF. I'm sort of listening to their explanation, taking copious notes. I'm walking out, and the guy points at my pad and says, that's classified. So I thought, okay, I see what's happening here. So we go out, talk about the reasons that they want the documents back. And frankly, it's just more information, because we never had any intention of giving the documents back. But at the same time, we're playing it out, and you're writing your next book, frankly.
Absolutely, yeah.
The contacts you had with people in the administration were bolstered by the first book, to get confidential sources and other people who will disclose things to you, which are really risky to them, takes a lot of time and effort, and you were doing that. At the time, we were sort of curious about whether your phone was tapped.
Mm-hmm.
I asked our contacts at Treasury that, and they said, oh, I just don't think we do that.
That's called the non-denial denial.
We
wouldn't do such a thing, I don't think.
Yeah, we tried making a formal request to find
you did several times.
Yeah, no luck.
Because I was in a position at that point where I'm saying, good God, Kurt. We knew I had found many of the disclosures that you're now reading about in the paper, guys like me or James Risen or other reporters, James Risen in the New York Times, we were finding these out in 05 and 06, and some of them are in the 1% doctrine. Now, of course, they've been expanded, widened, and deepened by Snowden releasing the actual volume of documents, but it became clear to me that the NSA's activities were vast and intrusive, just what we now know. So in our conversation, this is a conversation of a journalist and a lawyer. And it shows why, sadly, up ahead, every journalist is going to have his or her lawyer with them on a lot of these issues. I said, Kurt, every phone call I make, I'm probably spoiling a source. I'm not sure what to do. I mean, I can't operate like some guy on the lam in Karachi with, little cell phones I throw away. I mean, it's not going to work. I mean, I can't conduct my business as a reporter if I can't use a telephone, though I was trying to. I tried to use the phone as little as possible. And I even had conversations that were coded with sources about, so, Bill, how's the wife? Great. How about Cornelia? She's great, too. Yeah. Hey, would you meet us for brunch tomorrow morning at Bread and Chocolate? This is a place, I don't know if you've been to Washington, up near Chevy Chase Circle. There's a little eatery there called Bread and Chocolate. It's perfect for meeting sources.
Which really is the place for them to have tapped you, if any place.
Exactly.
Should have been the Bread and Chocolate.
Yeah. And they weren't thinking clearly. That was the spot to put the bug. So I'd meet people at Bread and Chocolate, and it got to the point where literally I was meeting so many people at Bread and Chocolate, I'd be there with one source and there'd be another one at another table. I'm like, go away. And the waitress, Ilka, at Bread and Chocolate was like, so today another friend of yours? She's from Lithuania or something. She was probably CIA. So Ilka was definitely, I'm thinking CIA. Well, I may be wrong. I was in an existential crisis here. Because I'm like, I can't compromise sources. They're trusting me. So we thought about a plan. And I had two advisors on this. I had Kurt, and I had a friend of mine. I had done stuff for a show that I know some of you remember, by a guy named Ted Koppel. Used to do shows on called Nightline, And I think Nightline's still on. But Koppel was the threat. And I used to do reports for Ted Koppel. So one of my friends was a senior producer at ABC News at Ted Koppel, Dan Morris. And so I said to Dan and Kurt both, I said, okay, here's the plan. I am going to call up Dan on the phone. And I'm going to say, Dan, meet me in the parking lot at Bread and Chocolate, Dan from ABC. And I will bring you 140 key documents. Okay? And then I'll hand them to you in the parking lot. I'll be wearing a blue shirt. And we wanted to see who would come to the parking lot. Want to give them enough time. So I said, 4 hours. The government is not all that efficient. So I figured 4 hours would be enough. But then Dan and Kurt both said, okay, this is an audacious concept here, Ron. And mind you, at that point, with the 19,000 documents from O'Neill, I was also considering doing something called disclose.com, which Kurt can tell you more about because he was my advisor on that. And Dan said, okay, do you want me to do the Bush press conference or do you want to do it the day you get caught when the sedans pull up like this afternoon and throw you in? I said, okay, you do it. And he does a pretty good Bush too. It's like, it's Suskan. He's making money off of classified materials. He's an enemy of America. He will rot in prison. I'm like, think that bad? Uh-huh. And then Kurt said, can we get your wife in on this discussion?
And that pretty much did it.
Yeah.
I mean, the short answer is you would have been handing over a blank DVD, or I think we discussed it maybe.
It was going to be blank. DVD. It was a Disney DVD, in fact.
Maybe Cinderella or something.
It was Beauty and the Beast. I thought that would work with Bush better. Lion King. I think it was the Lion King, actually.
Yeah, that would be good. So you were going to hand that over. Needless to say, there's nothing illegal about that.
I forgot it was a Disney DVD. That's true.
It was a nice touch. But to sort of, there's nothing illegal about baiting people who are illegally tapping your phone line into doing something like that. And we would eventually spring you. But it'd be an unpleasant few days. So we decided not to do that. So that we never to this day have known whether your phone is tapped, although I guess now we can figure out that it probably always was.
It probably was. So then I said, I was feeling agitated at this point because, I've been a journalist at this point 20 years and I am finding myself unable to do the thing I'm trained to do. So that's when I thought about doing disclose.com. Now, what that would be was, and I had run for a brief time an internet company, don't ask, it was for 1 year, but I did understand something about web architecture and encryption. So I said, maybe we could set it up in such a way that people can send in documents, electronic versions of documents, without it being traceable. And that was possible in that period, at least. That was the way the architecture was set up. And I would be the arbiter, as opposed to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, which had not, of course, they hadn't thought of it yet. But I, in my role as a journalist, was saying, I will sit there at the apex here and look at the documents and actually probably call the U.S. government and say, I've got something pertinent. So through the back channels that I operate and use, as all journalists do, as a reporter, I'd say, tell me if this is a problem for national security, and if so, why? And I can make that call, that decision, which is something newspapers and other journalists do. That was the way it was going to work. But again, this was a kind of thing that would mean I would not be able to see my children graduate from high school, much less college. So I end up not doing it.
It does underscore a really crucial difference between the way WikiLeaks works and the way you're talking about working in terms of documents. When you get a document, when the Post gets a document, when the Times gets a document, typically one of the first calls is to whoever at the intelligence community to say, okay, if this is published, what's the fallout?
Yep.
And then you can decide how much to publish. It's your call, but you're getting information about what to do, and that is the difference between sort of doing it responsibly and sort of just dumping 200,000 documents into a...
Right. So what you're seeing now are the codes of conduct that responsible professional journalists learn to embrace. It's subtle. But it had worked for a very long time. You know, we all live in the same country. You know, no one is going to willfully create a problem where people get injured. But the fact is, I have to balance that as the reporter with what the public has a right to know. That's what I do. That's my job. So here what you have is an intermediated system of leaks. And I would stand in this position. What I did, what I was ready to do, I of course do on the next book, The 1% Doctrine. Again, it's what Dana Priest of the Washington Post and James Risen does too. They get a document, they call up CIA, we have sources there, and we say, here's what I got. Okay, talk to me. We're off the record. Does this mean what I think it means? I make some calls. They figure out what they're going to say. We go back and forth. Book two of this series is called The 1% Doctrine. It's about the war on terror. It's about how America changed its character to fight this new type of war, and actually changed its character in ways that Al-Qaeda and others hoped we would. That was their goal. If you read Al-Qaeda documents, and plenty have been published before 9/11, they said, we cannot defeat a country of the might of the United States or Britain or any of the Western nations. But what we should try to do is create an overreaction, to do something as best we can so that they will overreact, react forcefully in a way that shows that their august principles are brittle. These principles that Al-Qaeda and others know truly are beacons to the world. I mean, you go around the world, they know about the Bill of Rights. They tack it up on their wall in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, saying someday maybe we'll get there. Al-Qaeda's view and others of their ilk was to show that America doesn't believe at any cost in those things. Get them afraid, and they will show that these are principles of convenience, not inalienable or immutable. We handed them victories because we proved their point. So, in the reporting for the 1% Doctrine, there was a lot of information that was secret in the book. The book comes out in 2006. Kurt and I are in negotiations all through this period as to what to do with 140 documents. Around this time, they say, all right, well, Susskind's office, which is a converted garage, it's not currently a garage, behind the house, is not a secure location. These are classified materials, and that is not a secure housing for said materials. Well, that's a pretty strong point. There's no doubt about that. My house is not a secure location. Ask my kids. I mean, there are parties there on Friday night, you know. Half the kids at Sidwell Friends are there. I mean, God knows what could happen. So they come away in a negotiation with Kurt. And how did you do that one? That was an interesting one about the two-key thing.
The two-key solution. The idea was you would bring the documents to an office building that happens to be owned by the CIA. And there are, as it turns out, any number of office buildings or office space setups in DC are actually owned by the CIA or the State Department or Treasury, or leased by them. So they'd set up something in an office building, which we in fact looked at, or maybe I just looked at. And
you looked at
away.
I didn't go, yeah, I didn't go.
But it was a standard office building, and the idea was we'd have a key and they would have a key.
And I could,
you could go visit your doc.
That's right. I put my documents there, and I could visit them. And they would have a key, and I would two double key arrangement.
Right.
And this seemed, I mean, it was clever. You know, it was mindful of the fact that I had some ownership over those, or at least some claim to those documents, which was a victory of our negotiations. But then Kurt was skeptical. What was your?
Well, the second time you come, the key is not going to work. It'll not quite fit, or the lock will have been changed mysteriously. They won't have a lease to that room anymore.
Right. I'd be on the phone with Kurt saying, "Is it say that I'm supposed to jiggle the key? What's the?"
Yeah.
So we decided not to do that. Now, the 1% doctrine comes out in 2006, and we'll get to Q&A in 1 second, but this gets right to the core of it. At that point, there's a meeting. The book comes out in June of 2006, and 3 or 4 days before it came out, copies were starting to sift out. People would go to bookstores and bribe the bookstore owner. It was embargoed until the Tuesday. It was the previous Thursday it started to leak out. And one ended up in the hands of the FBI. The FBI called a meeting at FBI, which had in attendance people from the CIA, a state, NSA, Justice, and the White House. They had Xerox copies of the one book they had. Everyone had their own little packet. And FBI said, this book is filled with secret, non-public, classified information. It's just jammed with it. And we need to prosecute this guy. We need to make an example of him. And we're ready. Now, at this point, across the table, a lawyer for CIA, who will remain nameless, said, you're not going to like this, but we were in an official conversation with this guy. It's back channel. He wanted to make sure that what he was putting in the book was accurate. And he did ask us whether some of these things were problematic in a real way to national security rather than just everything classified. And we made our case, and he was pretty mindful of it, actually. At which point, FBI kind of threw the book across the room. You idiots! Now, interestingly, also at the table is representatives of the White House, Karl Rove's team. And Rove's like, no, this is better. We don't want to prosecute him. That's what we did on the first book. We just sold his book for him. We don't want to do that and raise him into a peer combat with the President of the United States. Ignore it. Don't give him the oxygen of publicity. Now, the book was fine. It debuted at 2 on the Times list and everyone read it. But still, Rove was making an interesting point about the subtlety of this conversation. The subtlety that is right now getting banged up by the heavy footfalls of law. In this case, the White House read the book and said, you know, a lot of this stuff, ooh, very painful. But some of this stuff, you know, it is what happened. You know, Bush doesn't look half bad, and at least here and there. And it is about what's real. So ultimately, they were brought to understand some of the humbling complexities of representative government, even though they were particularly forceful in saying our way or the highway. Again, the way it was designed to work. There are many other similar examples of this in my third book, Way of the World, and many of books published in this period, in many articles in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And now we get to the present tense. And I'm sure many of you have read about what's going on with Snowden, what's going on with other sources. 7 investigations of leakers by the Obama administration. Boy, that was a Freudian slip. More than any other administration, more than all of them combined.